A palm inside the suitcase trick. Empty 50 caliber ammo boxes filled with napalm, fitted out with the fuse and wrapped with barbed wire. This device could be thrown over the trench wall. The explosion ignited the napalm and scattered metal and barbed wire fragments right, left, and center of the attacker. Unfortunately, there was a lot of wastage with this one. Troopers had a tendency to throw it at any and every noise, but at least we always roasted a couple of rats, and they were the enemy too. Higher headquarters kept insisting we were about to get clobbered. They wanted more patrols out, a screen to lie in wait and provide early warning. I fought them. It was true that patrols had the best vantage point of the front, and that it was mighty difficult for the enemy to move large formations without being picked up by them. But the temperatures were fast approaching zero at night, and the minute the boys got into position, their sweat-filled heavy rubber Mickey Mouse boots, newly issued and so named for the striking resemblance they bore to those worn by Walt Disney's famous rodent, froze from the inside out. I'd seen too many frostbite casualties in the 27th to go through that drill again, and proposed short roving patrols instead, in and out, but no laying up. Of course, because few at the top had ever been on patrol, much less in these bitching conditions, the nightly vigils in the valley were more often than not controlled by Corps, and the starched setup of the chain of command didn't seem to have the guts to challenge them. The order to stay out and ambush stood. Fortunately, it wasn't hard to fool the powers that be since we never had nighttime visitors. Each night I sent a small recon party down to the valley to have a good look around. No laying up was the rule. While back at home, we phonied radio traffic with the patrol leader in his platoon CP. The only reason we bothered to dummy up the traffic at all was Westy had told me Locke and staff monitored our internal radios. If only they had something more important to do, I thought, all too often. Once Locke commented about the excessive number of frostbite casualties Easy and George were experiencing, while we in fighter had none. His casual interest was the only time I thought our scheme would be found out. Happily, when I told him the boys of fighter changed their socks when they got in position and kept their fingers and toes moving, he dropped the subject and never brought it up again. It was a lie. In terms of the officer's code of conduct, a lie as bad as any other lie, including the blatantly approved lies then running amok through the officer corps prompted by those Korean certificates of loss. But the fact was, I was slowly beginning to see myself developing my own code of conduct, rather a code of conscience, the rules of which were based on the needs and welfare of my men versus regulations, or the desires of my higher-ups. The switch was unconscious. It had probably come with the raiders, if not before. The long-term ramifications were enormous, something I couldn't have known in 1952. But the little book of what really matters, what's really important, had begun to write itself in my head, and it was something I'd trust in the rest of my life. The morning of 18 December was cold and snow-covered. I'd stood the company down to 10%. We stayed at 10% during the day, 50% at night, and only when it hotted up did we stand to in the old British naval tradition with 100% of the force locked and cocked behind their weapons and in their fighting positions. And because there wasn't anything urgent to attend to, I went out to my OP to have a look at the battlefield before catching some shut-eye. The OP was equipped with the battery commander's BC scope, a highly magnified binocular periscope with which at 1,000 yards you could tell if a soldier had shaved that day. It was hard to put the thing to the test in the trenches, though. Our North Korean counterparts were masters of camouflage and deception, and during the day you could look into the enemy positions no more than 600 to 800 yards distant and not see a thing. Aerial photos for our area of operation showed their line to be entrenched in great depth, on the average, 14 miles, with the maze-like stacked positions having no tactical integrity, at least from a Western point of view. We'd heard that some of the communists' underground chambers could shelter whole battalions. I believed it. They were great diggers, but to look across the valley, you'd never know. As I'd expected, when I peered through the scope, all was quiet. but when I turned my attention to the pines, I saw white-on-white movement against the snow. I could barely believe my eyes. Bold as life, like animated snowmen, half a dozen North Koreans in over-white camouflage gear were rolling up commo wire abandoned by U.S. patrols at 11:30 hours. Guess they thought, it's daytime, Yanks, sleep, no one will see, and to the naked eye, it would have been true. Without the scope, there would have been no way to discern them against the landscape. I called Joe Rice, a great patroller at any time, but one who personally preferred daylight work. He immediately moved out with the 5-man patrol. He packed his own radio, so we had great commo. It meant I could watch Joe's movements and provide direction at the same time I kept my eye on the snowmen. In the meantime, I rang up newly commissioned Second Lieutenant Smith to get cracking with the backup element and gave my FO a warning order to be prepared to blow no-name sky high. I brought the company to stand to, told the platoon leaders the situation, and ordered a good old-fashioned turkey shoot as accompaniment to Joe's action in the valley, firing on order, keeping the stuff high and only on the enemy trenches. I didn't tell battalion what was going on until the very last moment. I wouldn't have told them at all, except they'd have gotten the word when the Arty people requested fire, and I knew it'd be better for me if I broke the news. It was just that I knew the minute I did, I'd have the entire chain of command from Corps on down on the horn telling me how to run my company. For my OP, I watched Joe positioning his people. I saw the carefree North Koreans working through the pines and disappearing into some old bunkers. I told Joe exactly where they were. It was like watching a silent movie, an amazing thing to watch an entire action from beginning to end in such detail and in such safety. Joe moved like a stalking tiger, his men providing security from concealed positions. A North Korean stuck his head out of a bunker. Joe shot him. The guy fell back, and Joe threw a grenade. I told him another North Korean was crawling out the left side of the bunker. He moved over and shot that guy, too. The North Korean rolled down the hill as Sergeant Allison opened fire on him. In the meantime, the North Koreans in the trenches on No Name woke up. A machine gun opened fire. One of our patrolmen fell. I pulled the chain and the turkey shoot began, like an erupting volcano. One enemy soldier got so excited that he jumped on top of the trench line, waving his arms wildly till he took a direct hit and was splattered across the hillside. I figured he was the company CO. Must have been even more shocked by what he saw in the valley than I'd been. Imagine watching one of your patrols being scooped up in front of your own main line of resistance, MLR, in broad daylight. It was a magic morning. With only one casualty of our own, we'd netted 2 POWs and 2 enemy KIA, not to mention those killed during the company turkey shoot. Through my BC scope, I watched Smitty's 9-man support group move swiftly forward to evacuate the POWs and our WIA. I told Joe's people to shift the enemy dead to a small clearing. That night, we laid an ambush, using the dead as bait. An enemy patrol fell right into the trap. Their comrades had frozen fast to the ground, and while a couple of white figures worked to break them loose, our ambush went into action and killed the whole enemy crew. All in all, it was not a bad day's work for fighter. Within a few hours of Joe's return, our position was inundated with visitors, battalion, regiment, division, corps, and army. Had President Truman bopped in, too, I doubt I would have been surprised. But it was my own fault, really. I'd unplugged my phone as soon as the patrol got home safely, when I was besieged by everyone for a first-hand report. Our prisoners were the first to be captured in ages. And when the POWs spilled the beans that they'd been tasked with getting intelligence for a regimental-sized attack, the North Korean recon patrol had moved into the pines that morning to get a head start, but had been undone by their patrol leader who couldn't resist picking up the rich man's wire. Higher headquarters got so excited they could barely contain themselves. We got stacks of replacements and top priority on everything. Another element was brought in east of the gap. G Company shifted over and took part of our line to give Rice's platoon, who would take the brunt of an enemy attack, a tighter, stronger position. All this was very nice, except that the whole thing had been completely blown out of proportion. What we'd had was a local fight. Beyond regiment, no one should have given it more than a second thought, and in a normal shooting-scooting war, no one would have. They'd have been too busy worrying about the big picture. How bad they were making the enemy hurt across the entire front, the hows, whats, and wheres that were necessary to break the enemy, positive winning thinking, to make them reach the point of giving up. But at this point, there was no big picture, save the peace talks, and no thoughts of winning at all, or so it seemed. As a result, bored, frustrated, higher-level commanders and their staffs had nothing to do but mess with the troops the whole way down to squad level. In this, the third year of the war, whether or not to hold a pimple of a hill had become an issue for 8th Army, the Pentagon, and sometimes the President. The only problem was that while these guys hemmed and hawed over whether to withdraw or reinforce, and the political ramifications of each option, down at the cutting edge, American soldiers died. It would come to be known as centralization. It gave middle management, battalion and regiment, an easy way out. They simply passed the buck up the chain of command. What do you think? I don't know. What do you think? Maybe we should call higher headquarters. Yes, that's what I think too. With no risk of failure to themselves. I generally unplugged my phone or reported only what I absolutely had to until the action was over or we really needed a hand. The big problem was artillery. Higher HQ would track your situation by that traffic. I always said I was going to get my own cannons, then no one would know a damn thing until I was ready to tell them. During this period, a regimental CO came to call. He told me he was planning, contingency planning, that is, a regimental attack to take some high ground directly to our front in an effort to tidy up the lines. He wanted me to have a look at the problem. We couldn't get a good view of the objective from my OP, so we drove up to First Bat where the picture was clearer. If you were a regimental commander, this colonel asked, and you were given the mission to take that objective, how would you go about it? Why, he was asking a first lieutenant whose military schooling was the 17-week infantry company officer's course at Benning, I didn't know. But based on what I knew from my Wolfhound experience and the countless hours I'd spent with Master Sergeant Flemings, I outlined a general plan. I'd jump off here, take that knob there, run some tanks and tracks down the valley while I had HE and Willie Peter artillery going on the top, maybe a couple of airstrikes here, some quad 50s there, then launch another battalion this way, etc., etc. The colonel soberly took it all in. Afterward, I forgot about it. About a week later, I was called in by the battalion S3 to be shown an operations plan, op plan. Word for word, tactic for tactic, it was exactly what I'd outlined to the colonel. I was amazed. It was like the Pope accepting and expounding an altar boy's interpretation of the Bible. The plan was never executed, but looking at it, like the phony silver stars for high-ranking guys who hadn't earned them, and the accepted lying on KCLs, was a real bolt from the blue. But General Cleland made up for all the pretenders in spades. He'd visited the company every couple of weeks since we'd come online, usually just a quick stop as part of his larger look at the regimental front. I'd liked him more every time I'd seen him, and he'd adopted a fatherly kind of attitude toward me. Now, just before Christmas, on the eve of the suspected enemy attack, he came up and spent half a day wishing the troops Merry Christmas and checking the positions. The general was the finest senior troop leader I'd known to date. He certainly knew his trade. He could slide behind a machine gun and know in an instant if its field of fire was right. He accepted incoming like Hudson, as a matter of course, and without even a blink. Before he left the position, we shared a pre-Christmas C-ration lunch in my CP. He asked me about my background and if I'd considered West Point. I told him about General Malloy and my minimal education. Cleland nodded, but did not comment. Christmas came and went. The big enemy attack came to naught. The North Koreans probably called it off on the assumption that the POWs we took had compromised it, and word flashed through the division that Cleland, the Great White Father, had walked a soldier's post in a bitter snowstorm on Christmas night after sending the Catholic trooper off to Mass in the general's jeep. My only present was a letter from home with a clip from Time magazine. It said that one newspaper, intent on gauging its readership's interest in the Korean War, ran the same story. Reds blasted from Vital Knob 3 days in a row. Apparently, there was not one call from either readers or reporters from competing papers. Yet the editor was quoted as saying, "If the paper omits a comic strip or football score, the office switchboard begins working frantically." I wondered if the friend who sent the article was trying to tell me something. With the new year came the final goodbye to Colonel Locke. The meanest mother in the valley was going home. His visits had grown less frequent as he became a short-timer. On one of the last, he'd been sitting on my sack, chewing tobacco and musing that he only had 28 goddamn days to go. Without thinking, I'd replied, "Oh no, sir, you only have 27. And he'd been surprised. "How did I know?" he asked. I was used to having to think quickly with Locke around. "In your battalion, sir, it's an officer's duty to know every important detail." I couldn't tell him we second bat officers were counting down his derose almost as eagerly as he. Locke's last day in the battalion was related to me by Dick Whedon, now HQ Company CO. Dick usually lived in battalion forward, but he went to the rear CP to make sure the colonel got off all right. He told me Locke had gone into the mess about 0530. Old soldiers don't know how to sleep in. And when the mess sergeant served him his eggs, Locke had looked at them, put his hand under the plate, and slammed the eggs over onto the table. "You goddamn people will never know how I like my eggs," he'd snarled. With that, he put on his hat, picked up his gear, one tiny AWOL bag when most senior officers had two or three footlockers, got into his Jeep, and drove away without looking back even once. At the end of February, we were relieved and sent back to 8th Army Reserve to train. Once again, we switched with the 5th RCT. The relief went without a hitch, but Joe Love, now a captain, was nowhere to be seen. He'd gone back to the States, chosen by General Van Fleet to lead an 8th Army Honor Guard at the head of Eisenhower's first inaugural parade. Joe was a good man. He well deserved the recognition. As we slipped off the hill, I saw my company together for the first time in 4 months. It was one of the great shocks of my life. Suddenly I thought I'd been commanding a company from the King's 1st African Regiment. There'd been no natural light in the underground bunkers. While Adkins had devised a great lighting system for the CP, a truck battery hooked up to a sealed beam headlight, the troops had had to come up with a field expedient. Some had candles, but for most it was mosquito repellent with a cloth wick. The latter sent off pounds of black soot, and with water rarer than good wine, no one ever thought to wash the grime off his face and hands. So it just sat there, getting darker and thicker until now, standing before me on that cold, cold morning wearing Mickey Mouse boots, long green field coats, and pile caps tied under their chins, were almost 200 black-faced hill people with straggly long hair, haunted eyes, and bedrolls under their arms. 6 weeks later, we were back on the line, this time east of the Gap. Oh, for the days, I'd sometimes think about our last position. It hadn't been good, but this place was horrific. We relieved a South Korean unit that must have known as little about field sanitation as it did about fighting. The position on Hill 930 was basically a foul-smelling open-air latrine. Our predecessors had crapped wherever the urge came. The stench only got worse as the snow melted, revealing North Korean bodies hung on the protective wire in various states of decay. When our CP line went out and wireman Hansen left the trench to fix it, in the dark he found a Chinese tennis shoe near the wire. It was a great souvenir, and he brought it back to show us. "Look what I found," he shouted as he burst into the CP, only then noticing in the CP's dim light the greenish-black communist foot that was still inside the shoe. He turned green, too, and immediately puked his guts out. The sun never seemed to shine here. Cordite and smoke generator fog kept the place gray and stinking. Nothing was growing. It had all been pounded away, making the hill like an elevated sandpit. Yet the incoming was still as regular as breathing. The noise was so deafening, the barrage so intense, sometimes that you were sure no one would survive. It's always the one you can't hear that gets you, you'd think, crawling inside your flak jacket while trying to figure the odds of one of those 120-millimeter Soviet mortar shells bearing your name. Amazingly, we took few casualties. The troops just screwed themselves deeper and deeper into the ground. I was proud of Fighter Company. The 6 weeks in reserve had been excellent as far as training was concerned. It had also been a fine getting-to-know-you period between the boys and me. The thing was, I'd only been with them 2 days before we went to the Gap, so there'd been no time to forge a relationship with them as a unit until we left the line. I'd sent an advance party complete with mess truck back to the reserve area early to square things away for the troops' arrival. It was snowing hard when the men detrucked, but no one seemed to mind. They stood around or sat in the snow, wolfing down their first meal in months without an ear cocked for incoming. When I arrived, Dick Whedon, who'd become a great friend and whom I'd requested and got as my XO, had bounced up to my jeep to usher me into the officer's mess tent he'd scrounged up, complete with tables, chairs, tablecloths, silverware, plates, and a red-hot stove. But this ain't right, I'd thought. The boys had just walked 2 miles through a snowstorm to the open trucks, where they'd shivered for 6 hours in brutally cold winds the whole way back to the reserve area. They'd passed through the light line, beyond which their rear echelon counterparts, squeaky clean and ever so warm, bitched in their heated tents and their heated mess because the guys on the line got $45 more than they did, combat pay, and 4 points versus their 3 for each month they were there. Now fighters' men were eating the same old chow in the snow right in the shadow of the only restaurant in town. I told Whedon to strike the tent. We'd eat outside in the snow and after the troops. That's how it was done in the army I came from. So the little officer's tent was struck, a move that had a dramatic effect on the soldiers. For the 4 months I'd been their CO, all they'd known about me was that I was a warrior. Now they saw another, more caring side. The thing was, you had to look after your soldiers. It was true that a CO's first priority was the mission, but a conflicting requirement was the welfare of the men. It was true that the whole purpose of the military establishment was to get a doe-foot eyeball-to-eyeball with the enemy, and it was equally true that the troops were the ones who paid the price, in blood, for an objective secured. These facts made and make an infantry CO a hanging judge. He has incredible power over the lives and deaths not only of a faceless enemy, but of his men. Sometimes his power causes a leader to become hardened. He stops seeing his troops as human beings. They become faceless assets to him. He becomes afraid to get close or to feel, instead constructing a concrete barrier in his head to keep out the guilt and the pain of lives lost at his behest. In the process, he forgets that though he may give the orders, it is the soldier who makes them happen, or doesn't. He forgets that if you want 100% from a trooper, you have to give him 200% as a commander. You have to keep your boys well-fed and well-clothed whenever possible, and well-trained always. You have to show respect for them, and you have to remember that every trooper is a priceless asset, not some easily replaced numbered part to be abused or wasted. An American leader cannot just take his place in a Prussian kind of caste system with its huge gaps between officers, NCOs, and enlisted men and expect his men to die for him in battle. It is as unrealistic, given America's long history of citizen soldiers, as it is wrong. The troops might respond for a while, but not for always, especially in an unpopular war. Of course, I didn't like eating in the snow any more than the men. So on top of the things to do in reserve list had gone the mission of building ourselves a proper mess. Everyone pitched in with the building and selective scrounging. Within 3 or 4 days, the thing was finished, and we'd gone on with the serious phase of what the reserve was all about. Training. I'd worked on a training plan based on what I considered my unit's deficiencies, and gone over it with Major Jack Hemingway, who'd replaced Locke as battalion CO. The two could not have been more different. Locke had been a foul-mouthed, ass-chewing, hard-driving son of a bitch. Hemingway was an anti-swearing, non-drinking, very serious meeting man. Most of the battalion officers had adopted Locke's habit of swearing every other word, so Hemingway's first order of business had been to clean up our mouths. The new commander had approved my training program, as long as I incorporated the official regimental training schedule as well. Regiment had lots of inspectors running around here, too. I got around their snooping by having my training area about 10 minutes from fighter company's sign, with an EE-8 telephone connecting the two. That way, I was able to do what I wanted, and if the training inspectors came around, my company guide at the sign would ring up and I'd have 10 minutes to get back to the regimental schedule. The boys were out of shape from 4 months underground, so we started with the basics, taking it slowly. Physical training, PT, short runs, and individual refresher stuff, including the lessons learned that I'd recovered in my little notebook. You all remember Private X and how he blew himself away? The reason he killed himself was he didn't know how to correctly probe for an anti-personnel mine. This is how you do it. We used a hands-on approach. We didn't talk about probing for mines. We probed for them, using dummy mines. We took long hikes, working up from 5 to 25 miles. Afterwards, I always checked the troops' feet. If I ran a trucking company, I'd look after the tires, and ordered all leaders to do the same, and to make sure their units had plenty of clean socks and changed them regularly. Fighter Company was excellently trained in defensive matters by the time we hit reserve, not just from being there in the trench war, but through our leaders and NCOs' constant drills on staying alert and staying alive. But in war, the purpose is to strike your enemy, not to sit back and wait for him to strike you. You defend only long enough to reach out, attack, and clobber your opponent, and you have to be prepared to do it confidently at a moment's notice. Any soldier who lived through that first year of the Korean War knew this. Unfortunately, young leaders who tried out their wings since we dug in did not, which was why I supposed the Army had cooked up reserves like this one, which was for training in the offense. This is notwithstanding the fact that no big attacks were in the cards at this stage of the war. Colonel Sloan, who'd gone from the Wolfhounds to 8th Army as chief of plans, repeatedly made plans for full-scale attacks at 8th Army C.G. Van Fleet's request, only to have them all turned down back in Washington. It seemed the basic criterion for any offensive operation, including those on the smallest of hills, was in fact a defensive one, to wit, is this piece of real estate a threat to our position? Fighters' unit training had begun with the smallest and most important element, the squad. 11 men would go on the attack with live ammunition, repeating the drill again and again, one squad at a time, until they were truly proficient. I made them train at night, too. One of the major shortcomings of Army training was its stupid dawn-to-dusk philosophy of fighting, despite the known fact that our enemy, who had almost zero air power, was forced to operate at night. Once the squads had their act together, we'd moved on to the platoon in the attack. When that became second nature, the training culminated in a company in the attack program in which the whole unit jumped off with live fire, just like a full steam-ahead wolfhound assault, except that no one was shooting back, and attacked a series of hills in the training area. It was fun, exciting, and a great learning experience for me. The first time I'd commanded a company-sized attack versus being one of the cogs that made the thing happen. But I just pretended I was old Jack Michaely back in the gallant George Company days, and it all seemed to turn out right. This final phase of the training had given Fighter a great sense of cohesiveness and confidence. It gave the men a chance to see for themselves what the maneuvering of infantry was all about, the employment of every possible bit of firepower brought down on an objective to pin the enemy down, and then the fire being lifted and shifted at the last moment so the guys could come up from under it to close with the enemy and destroy them with rifles and bayonets. The men could see the mortars dropping in, watching their interplay with the recoilless rifles, then understand how the machine guns, and finally they themselves, fit into this great concerto. All support fire was free fire. In real offensive combat, mortar rounds would pop right in front of the men and machine gun fire zing just inches over their heads. so the guys had to learn how to trust themselves and their buddies to know the gunners weren't going to hit them with poorly aimed fire. Safety was stressed, but not at the expense of overall realistic training value. The whole thing was very successful. General Cleland came down to watch and decided that all the rifle battalions in the regiment would conduct a company in the attack problem, with fighter as the demonstration unit for each. At $30,000 or $40,000 worth of ammo a shot, this was no small demonstration, and we got to do it 3 or 4 times. On the side, I'd conducted some classes on the basics myself. One evening toward the end of the reserve period, I had all the machine gunners in my CP teaching them MG night procedures I wanted followed. Then, in the darkness, came the unwelcomed growl of the EE-8. Lights off, I groped around and finally found the phone. The voice at the other end said, "Hackworth, this is Colonel Herrick." Colonel Curtis Herrick had recently replaced Colonel Herman Kesser, who'd replaced Colonel Truman as regimental CO. 3 in 1 year. Bingo. "I'm calling to tell you you've been promoted to captain. Just got your orders. I'd like to see you tomorrow." "Thanks, Dick," I said, thinking it was Dick Whedon, who did stuff like this. "But you don't sound a bit like Colonel Herrick, and I know I'm not promoted. Besides that, you're interrupting my class, so I'll talk to you later." I hung up. Within minutes, the phone rang again. This time, I recognized the voice. It was the regimental XO. "Listen, Hackworth, you were just talking to the colonel, and he was quite surprised with what you had to say." "You mean I'm really promoted?" The next day, I went to see the colonel. He had a little laugh about my unbecoming conduct the night before, but it didn't stop him from pinning on those tracks. When I left, I went right back to training, but I wasn't able to hike that day. I high-stepped it about 10 feet off the ground. And so did the boys of fighter, which was probably the nicest part of all. Confidence and morale soared for all of us in reserve. The bunker nerves, the little ticks brought on by incoming, disappeared, replaced by the cocky swagger of well-trained, well-motivated, confident studs. My only fear was what returning to Sitzkrieg after 6 weeks of training blitz would do to their spirit, but it proved to be an unnecessary concern. The guys were all old hands now as we went through the whole cleanup and rebuilding procedure we'd followed at the Gap. It went a lot quicker this time, and we saved a number of bunkers on the verge of collapse due to the early spring weather. Hill 930 was a steep, winding, 1,000-yard climb from the nearest road. A sandbagged station at the base held prepackaged supplies. SOP was both hands full, and a trooper's minimum load on the way up was 2 5-gallon cans of water, 100 pounds worth, or a case of C's, ammo, or radio batteries. This made for a bitch of a climb. It took a good hour considering the load you'd carry and your frequent dives into foxholes dug in along the way. We lived right in the shadow of No Name and another high enemy-held peak the troops called Stalin Hill, both of which looked right down on our reverse slope. Smoke generators belched out clouds of heavy white fog to deny enemy observation of particularly hot spots on this slope, which the North Koreans enthusiastically blew the hell out of. The ruse worked beautifully, except that the clothes, hair, and tongues of the hill people ended up coated with an oily, horrible-tasting film. We used large camouflage nets, too, to deny the enemy observation of the position, but these were frequently blasted, and it was a big, dangerous maintenance task to get them up again. The relentless incoming notwithstanding, the position was easier to defend than the one we'd left 6 weeks before. It consisted of 3 long ridgelines, each a steep, narrow, company-sized avenue of approach, with damn good wire and mine work. Other than the sanitation conditions, the South Koreans we'd relieved had actually kept the position in fine shape, that channeled the enemy right into our defensive fires. The outpost line was excellent, well dug, good wire, with a formidable squad-sized bunker in the military crest of each ridge, with a deep connecting trench back to the main line. A couple of 100 yards below, we had nighttime floating LPs, which would find the enemy and bop back to the nearest outpost, which in turn would call for help. Then we'd get artillery going, thousands of rounds worth, and flares to light up the sky, while the OP took the attackers under fire and scooted back to the line. By then, the rest of the company would be at 100% and ready to do battle, be it with grenades, bullets, or bayonets. There were no trees left on the hill, yet looking into the nighttime darkness beyond which lay the enemy, it almost seemed like an impenetrable jungle out there. In silhouette, you'd see metal stakes jutting up at weird angles, wrapped in barbed wire and haphazardly rooted in the earth. Around these were big rolls of concertina wire. In a way, it was a jungle, an awesome jungle of death, but by no means impenetrable. The North Koreans still had their gutty little sappers, damn good soldiers, all of them, who'd crawl up to the line and silently clip through or blow a hole in the wire with Bangalore torpedoes. Their infantry would be right behind to rush through the custom-made gap. Our OPLP system nipped most of the not infrequent enemy attacks right in the bud. Alert soldiers meant no Pearl Harbors, and our artillery defensive concentrations hammered down on the aggressors before they could breach the wire. One night, we got more than 50 enemy KIA without one trooper's weapon being fired. The enemy walked right into a killing zone and got smashed. The new 8th Army CG, an arty man from way back when, Maxwell D. Taylor, must have been crowing. I knew we were. The Americans really had the best and best supplied artillery in the world. Historically, it and the eager outpouring of our assembly lines had won every war since the North's heavily industrial base brought the South to its knees in the Civil War. Tactical skills, the abilities of generals, both came second to our capability to out-equip and outshoot our opponents. I often remembered Italy in 1946 when I was detailed to guard German prisoners of war. One of the prisoners was a damn tough lieutenant captured at Salerno. He spoke English, so I whiled away my duty hours giving him a hard time. Once I asked him why, if he and all his kraut friends were such brilliant soldiers and such supermen, was 15-year-old me the one holding the weapon and he was a prisoner of war? He answered me with a story. I was an 88mm anti-tank battery commander, he said. We were on a hill, and the Americans kept sending tanks down the road below. Every time they sent a tank, we knocked it out. They kept sending tanks, and we kept knocking them out, until we finally ran out of ammunition. The reason I'm here, he finished his story, is that the Americans didn't run out of tanks. Now the Air Force was doing a job on North Korea. 700 tons of bombs and thousands of gallons of napalm sometimes dropped on the capital, Pyongyang, in a day. It was a strategy of sorts. Bomb them back to the Stone Age to keep them at the bargaining table at Panmunjom. The only thing that didn't track was my memory of things I'd read about Nazi Germany. We bombed them to Kingdom Come too, but a month before the surrender, their wartime production levels were at an all-time high. Still, this doubt was easy to put aside when you were stuck in the trenches and the enemy was on the move. The more arty, the more air, the better. One attack that did get through fighters' barrier defense was localized to 2nd Platoon. When I saw that the rest of the company wasn't under attack, my RTO and I went racing down the trench to lend a little moral support. A mortar round came crashing in on top of the sandbag-lined trench right between us. Fortunately, it didn't knock me down. In fact, it kind of inspired me to pick up the pace on the downhill stretch. The RTO was packing a PR-10, and I had the handset. The radio cord between us went taut. He wasn't keeping up. After a few feet of this, I turned around to tell him to stop dragging his ass, only to find it was about all he could do, and that was only because I was there pulling him along by the radio cord. The RTO no longer had a head. He must have walked right into that mortar round. 3 feet ahead of him, I'd been untouched. It was the luck of the draw, and my first thought was I needed another RTO. One of the things about combat that remains unexplainable to those who've never experienced it is the apparent callousness in the face of death. I'd learned the first year in Korea that in war a soldier or a leader is about as indispensable as the hole left by a finger in a glass of water. Every good leader is missed, as an individual, and there are never enough real leaders. But there is always someone to pick up the chips and do the job. A few days after my RTO was killed, I had to brief 4 NCOs who were to lead a complicated patrol. We met at first light, the only time we could get away with it without being blown away by enemy sniper or mortar fire, and lay down in an open 75mm recoilless rifle position. The sun was just rising as we poked our heads up, eyeballed the fog-enshrouded objective and rally points, and discussed the plan. When I finished issuing my order, I ducked and weaved my way back to my CP bunker, leaving the two patrol leaders and their FOs to tie down final details between themselves. Just as I was about to enter the bunker, I heard a whoosh and an earth-shattering thump. Ugly black 120mm mortar smoke rose from the position I'd just left. I ran back to find one leader dead, one guy with gaping chest wounds, and the other two minus legs, all from one round, out of the blue, right on target. I couldn't do anything for the chest wound, not a cobweb in sight, but I thrust my hands into the legless men's stumps to stop the wild rush of blood pumping out of their femoral arteries. I held on until the medics took over. Before long, litter-bearers had the KIA and wounded leaders on their way down the torturous windy hill, and I was left with the problem of who the hell to get to lead the raid. Of course, replacements were found, and the patrol crossed the LD on time. The fact is, generally there's no time out for mourning on the battlefield, but it's really no different than the father of 10 who comes home to find his house on fire with all his kids sleeping inside. He doesn't stop and cry over the first child he finds dead. To do so would be to sign a death warrant for the other 9. A CO is often in the same situation. To do anything but continue on would be complete dereliction of duty, and in the larger picture, could possibly lead to even worse carnage among his troops. So do what you have to do, and only later, when things settle down, do you allow yourself to grieve. Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Mansfield, who'd replaced Major Hemingway, who'd replaced Colonel Locke as battalion CO, came up to see us every week or so. I liked him. He was an old friend of Cleland's, well-educated, a World War II airborne vet who regularly held forth on international and big-picture events. He took a keen interest in my development, offering almost fatherly advice about military ways. All in all, he was a good man who always wore his .45 along his spine under his web belt, a trick I loved and immediately adopted for my own. Mansfield was always cheerful when he trooped the position. At first, I'd been worried, because just days before we went back online, he and I had gotten into a flap over parade ground antics. I thought the troops' time could be better spent, and told Mansfield so in downright rude terms. It was not very wise, but at 22 I never got high marks for tact. I always charged in and ended up with my size 11 boot right in my mouth or ass. In this particular case, I'd inwardly excused myself somewhat because I was still excited over another big surprise I'd received in reserve, in some ways even bigger to me than being promoted. I'd been about to take the company on a tactical field march when I saw a wolfhound jeep coming down the battalion street. It had no business being there. The wolfhounds were about 150 miles away on the west coast. The jeep had come to a screeching halt in front of Fighter, and out jumped this little guy with a walrus mustache. He started running toward me, and by the time I realized who it was, the one and only Fred Crispino had thrown his arms around me in a big bear hug. Chris had been over in the wolfhounds waiting for me all that time as first sergeant in dear old George. He figured I'd never made it, and I'd plumb forgotten our rendezvous because of the rush of getting Fighter's edge honed sharp. He'd only found out where I was when he noticed my name in an article about Fighter Company in Stars and Stripes, at which point he'd gotten permission to make tracks for the Eastern Front. We had a wonderful reunion, like the good old Raider days. Chris stayed in the BOQ, and we drank, sang, gambled, and told war stories the whole time he was there. It was great seeing this dear friend whom I respected so much. I tried to talk him into coming over to the fireball, but he wouldn't. We were best buddies, but Chris was a wolfhound first. We decided that the war was shit, and nothing in Korea was worth fighting for, if for no other reason than South Korean President Syngman Rhee. In a drunken rave, we realized that an Oriental with a name like that should have been suspect from the beginning. Still, the war must go on, we'd said with the final hug. Then he got back into his jeep for the journey west, and I lost my temper with Colonel Mansfield. Happily, we'd patched it up by the time we went up the hill. Mansfield had ordered us to paint our faces with C-ration instant coffee. He really was a smart old fox who realized the yellowish-skinned disguise might buy our U.S. unit a bit of time after our relief of the South Koreans. Now that we were up there, his visits were uniformly welcome. Besides the colonel, though, guests were few and far between to this position. Even without the incoming, the steep climb to reach us was generally enough to keep them away. Still, Mansfield would occasionally call to say he was going to bring up some VIP or another, senators, congressmen, generals. To them, coming to our position would mean they'd been there. To me, it meant my troops were going to be harassed, since they would have to be preparing for an inspection when they could be getting some sleep. So we developed a very effective technique to keep unwanted guests away. Whenever I heard a VIP was scheduled, I'd have the attached 75mm recoilless rifle section poop out a few rounds. Boom, boom, boom. Very loud, with the attendant puffs of black recoil smoke, which looked exactly like incoming. Within moments, the phone would ring. "What's happening up there?" "Just an extra dose of incoming," I'd say. "Nothing to worry about." It wasn't exactly a lie. We averaged from 400 to 800 rounds of incoming a day across the company front anyhow, and by now the enemy had usually thrown a little something extra our way in response to the recoilless rifles. "I see," would be the reply. "Maybe it's not such a good idea to come up there. Maybe we'll take Congressman Smith over to Easy instead." This game ended when word came down that ammo was to be rationed. Every round, including M1 slugs, would be accounted for. The rationing was off if you got hit, but in the meantime, it was lean time, with the austerity program greatly restricting even H&I, as the most severe rationing was of mortar and 155mm ammo. The whys for the rationing were first explained as long-term strikes in the U.S. This had a devastating effect on the troops' morale. It was hard enough to live like cavemen and risk death every second in a meat grinder war to keep Asia free, for the soldiers to be shortchanged because of stateside greed and industrial strife was more than a little hard to accept. Then word filtered down that wrapped around the strikes were miles of Pentagon red tape. New procedures set up to improve the system had actually stopped it dead in its tracks. An ammo order now had to go through 42 different departments before even one round was issued. To the guy on the line, this snafu was just another stitch unraveling from the seam of the American effort. And how it was all happening with Eisenhower in the White House was hard to believe. Most of us were so happy to have him there. We knew Ike would stop this carnage, even if he had to drop the goddamn A-bomb to do it. But it was hard to square this great general president with the bullshit that 8th Army continued to put out, to wit, that we were the best supplied army in the world. They continued to chant that the enemy was being stretched to the breaking point logistically, while down at the cutting edge we knew the truth. Every day we saw and felt the communists hitting us with twice what we could answer back with. Fortunately, the rationing did not last that long, but a minute would have been too long. Meanwhile, life went on Hill 930, and an interesting thing started to happen in fighter company. The boys doing all the fighting were doing it very well. They seldom got rattled. They handled incoming and probes in steady stride, like pros, and day by day were getting even better. Yet at the same time, the quality of the chow was getting worse and worse. We had only one hot meal a day, and every night it was colder and more awful than the one we got the night before. An army travels on its belly, or so said Napoleon. Food, mail, and 36 points were about the only damn things the troops had to look forward to, and the crap they were eating limited the horizons a bit too much. I began a little investigation, only to find that the mess sergeant and cooks were completely burned out. Cajoling and threatening them didn't work, and when I realized nothing short of lining them up against a wall would, the only course of action was to fire everybody. I made rifle squad leader Sergeant Bravo mess sergeant, and he went to the troops. Any of you guys cooks in civilian life? He got about 200 volunteers. It seemed that every Hill person had been a French chef in some fancy restaurant, or so he said. Bravo took the most promising off the line, and almost immediately they started putting out truly incredible meals. Unlike the old crew, my gung-ho newly ex-infantry cooks knew well how important food was to the guys online. Suddenly, we were eating French and Italian, and Bravo's hailing from New Orleans guaranteed some wild Cajun delights. How the new cooks scrounged all the good things they did was something I was probably happier not knowing. But there was no doubt in my mind that Napoleon would have decorated Bravo's raiders on the basis of the first bite every night of the week. The mess experiment worked so well I decided to do it on the supply end, too. My supply sergeant was a nice guy, but his heart wasn't in it. He just didn't appreciate that extra pair of socks or that extra can of rations. So I replaced him with Sergeant Tui, another fine rifle squad leader who instantly became a master scrounger. There was nothing that boy couldn't get. "Here you are, sir," he'd say, flashing a great grin as he plunked his newest acquisition down before me. Sometimes I wondered if I should ask him for North Korean General Kim Il-sung's head on a platter. It might have brought the war to a speedy end. After the food was squared away, Bravo got the idea of giving the troops a midnight snack of soup and coffee. Brinkley, one of the new ex-infantry cooks, thought this was a great idea and volunteered for the job. He organized a Hill kitchen in a vacant bunker near the company CP, and soon every night we had hot soup from those delicious dehydrated soup packets and fresh, strong coffee when we'd needed it most. Then, in accordance with the great American dream, evolution occurred. Before I knew it, Brinkley had a big production bakery going on top of the hill. He carefully lined the hub of his booming enterprise with ammo containers to make it rat-proof and outfitted it with stoves and all kinds of kitchen paraphernalia. At midnight, the warm aroma of cinnamon rolls and coffee cakes, hot soup and coffee, wafted through the position. Runners from each platoon shuttled mouth-watering treats from the bakery to their buddies. No doubt it pissed off the North Koreans who didn't get a share. Now and then they'd send a mortar round in Brinkley's direction, and our resident baker was probably the only cook in 8th Army to get wounded 4 times. But the wounds were always superficial. None of the cakes seemed to fall, and the bakery was always open for business the next night. About this time, I heard a story that the George CO who'd gotten Bravo's patrol shot up had shot and killed a young Oklahoma A&M DSC-winning lieutenant. I was sick. I didn't know the lieutenant, but still felt a heavy weight of responsibility for the incident, because I'd had a confrontation with George 6 in reserve, which almost mirrored the events that led to the young lieutenant's death. I'd been sitting at a long table in the BOQ with Smitty, Westy, Price, and a new great young officer from Boston named Richard Alexander, when suddenly George 6 came storming through the door, followed by his red-headed XO. "What's up, Captain?" I asked him. He looked really weird, eyes all bulged out, melted snow dripping off his flushed red face, but just about the same time I realized he was drunk. He pulled a .45 caliber pistol out of his parka and pointed it at me. "I'm going to kill you, Hackworth," he said. I didn't know what was going on. I would have thought it was some kind of drunken gag, except that he then advanced toward me, pointing that cannon at my head very earnestly. I shot a glance at Westy. "Do something." "Hold on, hold on. What's the flap here, Captain?" I asked. "You took my machine gun, and I'm going to kill you." "What machine gun?" I was at the center of the table. Westy was on the west corner, a little farther down, rear and flank, so to speak, of the drunken CO as he moved closer and stuck the pistol under my nose. As George 6 began a disjointed tirade about the recent relief and Hill property and some machine gun he'd said we'd taken that screwed up G's switch with her relieving company, out of the corner of my eye I saw Westy slowly moving his hand toward the strap of a steel pot hanging nearby. In an instant, Westy had hurled that pot at the side of George 6's head, and I was on my feet smashing at the captain's wrist. He dropped the weapon, and I hit him from the ground up. The punch drove him into the corner of the GP tent. I rushed over to his spread-eagled, bullying ass and stomped him with my Mickey Mouse boots. I stomped him with the fear of the last minutes. I stomped him with long-time hate accrued since he'd shot up Sergeant Bravo's patrol and killed two of my men. The cleats and metal shoelace hooks on my boots did a job on his face. I stomped him until he was almost dead. Then a couple of us picked him up and threw him out into the snow. We roughed up his XO a little, too, and booted him out the door. The next day, Hemingway mentioned that George Six looked as if he'd run into a freight train. "Yes, sir," I'd said. "I heard he fell in the snow." Hemingway glanced at my raw fist. "Yes, Hackworth, I heard that, too." Now, in light of the news about the lieutenant killed by George Six's hand, I realized I should have told Hemingway what happened. I should have pressed charges on that drunken madman. I don't know why I didn't. Perhaps because I'd reported the pity incident to Locke at the time, and nothing had been done about it. Besides, I'd seen tons of examples of what too much booze and combat raw nerves did to people. From my first day in Italy, in fact, at the end of the war. Usually a little eye-for-an-eye justice straightened these guys out, and I figured it would work on George Six, too. But it hadn't, obviously, and the circumstances of the lieutenant's death were too close for comfort. The story went that George Six had pulled his .45 on the kid, who was a regimental liaison officer, and threatened to kill him if he didn't get out of his sight. The lieutenant was reported to have said, "You don't understand, sir. The regimental commander has asked me to come and discuss this matter with you, and I'm here on his authority." To which George Six replied, "I told you to get out, and I told you I was going to shoot you if you didn't, and..." Bam. George Six blew the lieutenant's brains out. I never heard if the captain was put away over the incident, but it was too late anyway, and it was something I would regret for the rest of my life. When General Cleland established a King for a Day program and selected me as the first king, I didn't want to go. I'd been with Fighter almost 9 months now, and I'd never left my unit before. Some protective, superstitious instinct kept me there, as if something terrible might happen and I wouldn't be around to help. But I got leaned on by Colonel Mansfield, and when he assured me the whole thing would only be 24 hours, I hot-footed it down the hill, all the way back to the land of electricity and running water. The purpose of Cleland's program was to find out problems at the fighting level firsthand, and at the same time honor the rifle company skippers who carried the true burden of the war. As such, it was VIP treatment from the moment I arrived at division until the moment I left. I took my first shower in 3 months, put on clean new fatigues, and dined, with the few awkward manners I had, in the general's mess, a room full of white tablecloths, crystal glasses, and gourmet food served on sparkly china by orderlies in starched white jackets. Tough way to fight a war. But I couldn't begrudge Cleland. He was every bit a soldier, despite the luxury that came with his job. I sat with the general during his morning and evening briefings and spent much of the rest of the day checking in with G3 operations to find out what was happening in Fighter's sector. That night, Cleland and I had a long talk about my future. He was worried. He told me the Army was going through one of its most significant changes in 100 years, and there would be no room in it for me. For the first time ever, America was going to have a standing army. This Cold War was here to stay, a new army where being a top fighter and troop leader would not be enough. The war would soon be over, there would be cutbacks, and the first to go would be officers without education. I had to go to college, he told me, or West Point. He felt I had great potential to rise to senior rank if I got that little bit of sheepskin to show I was a thinker as well as a warrior, and he said he would help me in any way he could. Cleland was from the Army of Soldiers. He seemed saddened by what he was telling me, by all the changes he saw coming. And for myself, after 2 years in the officer world, I still thought like a sergeant, meaning I just assumed I'd go from one unit to the next throughout my career, training troops and making them better. Now, suddenly, the emphasis was on making me better, in the classroom of all places, and I didn't know what to think. I lay awake most of the night on the wonderful fat mattress of my 3-quarter bed at division. I hadn't given much thought to my future. I still had a while before my 3-year officer commitment was up and had hoped to see it out with Fighter. Mansfield was pushing me to go home. I had my 36 points, but I didn't want to. The war would soon be entering its 4th year, and as much as I hated it, I couldn't see myself walking away. A slow bitterness welled up inside me. I'd served my country. Well, I hoped. God damn it, I thought, what's so damn important about a college education or West Point? I only wanted to be a company commander, and after almost 7 years at company level, one thing I was sure of was you didn't need to be some mental wizard to kick ass, take names, and run a good outfit. All you had to do was know your job and be fair and square. In reserve, I'd been asked a million times, "What class are you?" meaning what class of West Point. I'd never known how to respond till somebody said, "Tell them you're Korea, class of 50. Well, that I was, and damn proud of it, too. I'd helped kick red asses with every bit of energy I had that first horrible year of the war. I'd raided through their positions during the 2nd year when the war turned static, and then come back to sit in the goddamn trenches for another year still. I'd watched green forces commanded by a lot of self-serving amateurs, field-grade officers,